University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features lawyer and lecturer Sarah Weddington presenting the topic, You Can Make a Difference. A native Texan, Weddington graduated from Texas University Law School at age 21, and 5 years later won the landmark Roe v. Wade case before the United States Supreme Court. In the same year, Weddington was elected to the Texas House of Representatives, the first woman ever elected from Austin. In 1978, she became general counsel for the United States Department of Agriculture, and the same year was appointed to the White House to serve as President Carter's assistant on women and minority affairs. She has since returned to private law practice in Texas.
I was really delighted to have this invitation to visit with you today because in so many ways, when I look at you, I see myself years ago. Because probably like a lot of you, I came from small towns. Mine were Texas, but they were towns like Mundy, Canyon, Vernon, places you have never heard of. And then after graduating from high school, I went to a small Methodist-affiliated liberal arts college named McMurray in Abilene, Texas, lived in the dorm, was active in student affairs, and have had such a great time since then. You know, I look back on those college days, and part of what I think about is that the things I learned in class were important, but the things that have really made the fun of my life have been the things I learned while on campus, but not necessarily in class. For example, one of the things I did was learn leadership. I started out as a very young woman as president of the Methodist Youth Fellowship because my father was the preacher, and so I tended to be very active. I was in chanters. Well, as I was growing up, it started out with Methodist Youth Fellowship. I was the drum major for the junior high band. I was in band. I was in choir. In high school, I was the president of the Future Homemakers of America, of Canyon High School. In college, I was secretary of the student body. In law school, I was secretary of my law class. But part of what happened in my college training was that I was practicing leadership. Now, I really didn't think about it that way at the time. But as I look at what's happened to me since then, the things I did in college made it easier for me to go on. Or, for example, we are here on this set because the drama department is getting ready to do a production, and that's why we're moving, because the production crew needs to come in at 11. Well, I played Esmeralda in By the Skin of Our Teeth, the Thornton Wilder's production, and being able to learn to project, to be in front of an audience, to do high school debate probably meant more to me in terms of communication skills than most of the classes I was in. I see you here, and I see myself. But what I also see is the need that the country has for you in a new way. You see, one of the things that has made this nation are leaders. If you go back and you look 200 years ago, you look at people who said, we don't like the way things are going. We think King George has made some real mistakes. We're going to try to change things. And they didn't say, now what's in it for me? They didn't say, how much am I going to get paid if I start a revolution? But they did say, what can I do to make things better? And they had these ideas, radical ideas at the time, about a constitution, about a democracy, about setting up a new nation, but they started out to do it. And if you look at the cities, communities, organizations we're a part of, we are still involved in that process of saying, how should it be? How can we make it different? And needing leaders. In fact, if I look at the things I've done, I look at the fun of my life. Appearing before the Supreme Court. You know, for anyone who's a lawyer, that is the top of the line. And for someone only a few years out of law school, it's even more awesome. Because I was 25 when I first argued before the Supreme Court. And one of the things that happened to me was after I won that case, I had to go back to Austin and figure out how to do traffic tickets because I'd never done that. But the night before the Supreme Court argument, you know how you are before a big exam? And you keep thinking, oh, what if they ask me such and such? And you'll get up to check your notes and just be sure you've got it right. And then you go back to bed and you think, okay, what if they ask such and such? And you get up and you check those notes. And the night before I was to appear, the whole night went like that. And I was getting up to think, oh, what if they ask me such and such? And then I went over to the court the next morning. And you've seen those pictures of the marble stairs in front, the two big statues on either side. When I got over there, there was a line of people out the front, down the side, and around the corner, all waiting to get in and hear the oral arguments in Roe versus Wade. I went up those marble stairs and in through those big front doors. If you're not arguing a case, you have to immediately turn to the left and go and check all your parcels and packages, because in the Supreme Court, you're not allowed to talk or whisper or chew gum or look at your notes or do any of that sort of thing, so you have to check all that. If you're arguing a case, then you go and get a little certificate that allows you to take your materials into the courtroom. And then down a marble corridor, about three times as long as this auditorium. And you know how your steps will echo on marble. In through security just before you go into the Supreme Court chamber. And then in the chamber, there are really heavy red velvet curtains that keep any noise from the outside from coming into the courtroom. And at the back of the courtroom, as you go in, are three sets of church pews, or they look just like church pews. One side is the five-minute section for people who just come in for 5 minutes and they have to leave, the tourists. And then two sections for those people who've been standing in line all morning, first come, first serve, and who, if they're in that section, can stay as long as they like to hear the entire oral arguments. And then there's a gold railing that separates the layman from the lawyers. And if you're admitted to Supreme Court practice, there are some small but ornate chairs that you can sit in, and you're entitled to stay and hear the entire arguments. And then two big library tables on each side, because when the Supreme Court hears oral argument, they hear two cases in the morning or two in the afternoon. So the first case to be argued will be first tables up and the second case right behind it. I was first case up, plaintiff, so I was first table to the left. And when you take your place at those tables to argue, there is a handmade goose quill pen. It's a custom that dates back to the time of Thomas Jefferson, and it's a souvenir for you to take for having argued in the U.S. Supreme Court. And then there is a very small podium, a little less than this one, very close to Justice Berger and the justices, where you will stand. And on it is what I call a cheat sheet, but it's a diagram of where the justices sit. So if they ask you a question, you can answer them by name. Now, Sandra Day O'Connor is real easy to tell. Justice Marshall's easy. But if you're nervous, Powell and White sort of look alike, and so you can use this sheet to be able to tell who's asking the question. On the right is the section for family and friends of the justices, and it was absolutely packed that day. On the left was the section for the press. It was absolutely packed. And as I sat there just before the court was starting, I was sitting in this room, 13 kinds of marble, big marble columns along both sides, very high ceiling like this, only it's one of those very ornate with gold gilt and greens and blues. And it's a very formal place. And when it's time for the court to start, the clerk of the court comes in and cutaway tails and striped pants. And he says, "Oh yea, oh yea, oh yea, all ye, please rise and face the court." And there's this hush. Everyone stands, and the velvet curtains at the back part, and the judges are silhouetted in their black robes, and they start marching forward. I had a friend who said there was organ music playing in the vestibule. That's not true. But it's awesome. And you have 30 minutes to argue a U.S. Supreme Court case, 30 minutes per side. Because the theory of it is that you are not there to tell the justices about the case, that they've already read the briefs, they've read all the materials, and in this case, I do think that's true, and that you're simply there to answer their questions. And so from then on, it was just quick questions. You know, I remember in con law class, every once in a while, a professor would get me up, and you know how sometimes they won't let you sit down, and they just keep asking you questions and keep at you. And then when I was before the Supreme Court, I thought, you know, my professor in con law, George Schotsky, did a wonderful thing for me, because if I could stand up in front of George Schotsky, I could stand up in front of anybody. But it's that real questioning. And then, of course, I won the case, which was fantastic. In fact, I did get what you can get if you win a case before the Supreme Court, and that is an autographed photograph of the justices who were on the court at that time. So I have my photograph, I have my goose quill pen, and someone once said to me, well, can you get a photograph if you lose a case before the Supreme Court? And I said, I don't know, I've never lost a case before the Supreme Court. Or from there into politics. You know, I'd never thought about running for politics. And then between college and law school, I was a clerk typist for the Texas legislature. And when I wasn't back there typing the legislation or proofing the bills, I would go out and watch what was happening on the floor of the House. There's an old saying in Texas politics that says there are two things people should never see made. One is sausage, and the other is law. Because what I saw as I watched that process was a process that I didn't think was all I'd hoped it would be. And so I decided that maybe I could run for the Texas legislature and hopefully do a better job than some of those I was watching. And so I ended up running for the Texas legislature and was the first woman, as you know, ever elected from the capital of Texas, which is Austin. And when I got there, I found out they weren't quite ready for women. There'd never been one before from my county, not many from others. And so when I arrived there, I started getting invitations, and mine said, you and your wife are cordially invited. And so I wrote back and said, well, that didn't seem quite right. And then I got the ones that said, you and your spouse are invited. I was married, but others weren't. So they wrote back. By the end of that first session, we were getting the ones that said, you and whoever you want to bring. But now we see so many more women involved in politics and leadership, although still very few. And from there, I had never thought of going to Washington. But in the legislature, I had a wonderful opportunity to change credit laws, rape laws, to equalize custody laws. You see, the old law in Texas was that if there was a divorce and there were children of tender years, it was presumed they would go with the mother. And we changed it to say the proper test is which parent is the better parent to care for children. And it was part of that whole movement of saying fathers are also important in their children's lives. It was a chance to pass a kidney health care bill that meant kidney machines available to those who needed them and couldn't afford them. I had a chance to pass legislation relating to the Department of Public Safety, because at that time there was only one designation for state troopers, Patrolman 1. And to make more money, you had to be promoted to a supervisor. But a lot of the men wanted to stay exactly where they were. They just wanted to make more money. And so we did Patrolman 2 and Patrolman 3. And now we have more women who are also going into law enforcement. But it was a whole variety of things I was able to do. And I was sitting on the floor of the Texas House one day when a man I'd known, John White, had been Secretary of Agriculture in Texas, and he called me and said, Sarah, why don't you come to Washington and work here? And I said, John, I've always said I would never leave Texas. And he said, well, talk to your friends and see what they say. So I talked to people on the floor of the Texas House, and they said, Sarah, Washington is a place with no country and Western music, no barbecue, no Mexican food. It's not civilized. But I ended up going. Because in government, that's the top of the line. And I had a wonderful time. In fact, it was very hard to leave Washington. You know, I was talking to Betty Ford not long ago because I did an article with Betty Ford, Rosalynn Carter, and Lady Bird Johnson, three first ladies, about Washington and about the Constitution, about women. And you've been reading in the papers how Mrs. Reagan is saying that she kind of hates to give up living at the White House. And I was talking to Betty Ford about that, and she said, yes, she said, Sarah, and whoever takes your place in the White House, you really feel they did not deserve to be there. And, of course, Rosalynn Carter was sitting there, and she said, you are so right. Because everybody feels that way. Or there I was, used to spending weekends at Camp David, flying Air Force One, having dinner with Margaret Thatcher when she was in town. And when we would come to work in the White House, because my office was in the West Wing, just above the Oval Office, there would be a photo gallery on the left. And it was usually the pictures of the president and the Pope the last time he came, or the pictures of the president and the U.S. hockey team when they beat the Russians, or the president with the president of Egypt and the premier of Israel when they signed the Camp David Accords. And so you'd come to work and you'd think, oh, this is so good. And you'd look at those pictures and feel proud. And then came the day we lost the election. Everybody I knew, including me, had just lost their job. We were very tired. We were very dejected. We felt the American public didn't understand what we had tried to do. And I came to work the next morning sort of dragging in, and there were no pictures in that gallery. Instead, someone had posted an article, and it read, 50 things you can make for Christmas for less than $5. But I wouldn't give for the experience of having been involved in those issues and with the levers. There's also a tradition on the last day of an administration, and it will be followed come January. And that is that the people who've served an outgoing president come to work that last morning, finish cleaning out their desks, go down and have coffee and rolls with each other, and say goodbye to those they've worked with. And they go out the back doors of the White House to Andrews Air Force Base, where they will be there to wave goodbye to the departing president. And in through the front gates of the White House at 11 come the new people who have been selected by the incoming president to be the key officials for that administration's White House staff. And in the residence, it's only slightly different. The final change does not take place until the oath of office is seen on TV. And at that moment, the departing president's final things are packaged up and sent out to Andrews to go home on the plane. And the new president's things are brought over to the White House, usually from Blair House, which is half a block away. So by the time the new president goes through that inaugural walk or ride, as the case may be, the inaugural parade, and they get to the White House, their bathrobe will be on the bathroom door, the pictures will be out on the piano, it will in essence be their home. And so in an hour, we in this country have a complete change in government. And it is something we have every right to be proud of, that the people rule by their vote. And it is one of the reasons I hope all of you will participate in that process next Tuesday. As I left the White House, though, one of the things I decided I really wanted to do was to help focus on encouraging more women to be in leadership positions and encouraging more men and women to think of civic and volunteer leadership as part of their futures. You see, I think you are here in college partially to learn to make a living, because most of us have to do that for a significant portion of our lives. But I also think you're here to learn to make a life. And part of living a life that seems significant and worthwhile to me is giving something back to society, generally through volunteer, civic, perhaps political leadership. If I look at those issues, I am so conscious that all of us live, we work, we pray, we play in groups. And groups do not work well without leaders, because part of what happens in a group setting is that you need some people to help set the agenda, to help move the group forward, and some of you have been in groups that just don't work well. It's one of the things about this national election that we've read a lot about, people saying, look, in a country with 250 million people, why can't we find better people to run for office? People we feel better about. Well, part of it, I think, is that business has always known that if you're going to have continuing leadership, you have to train people. When you go and do interviews, business is looking for people with leadership or management potential. And then once you're employed, they give you a variety of training experiences. They expose you to different parts of the business. They know they have to train leaders. But in society, we've sort of always assumed that whenever we need leaders, they'll just be there. And so we haven't put that same effort into trying to train a generation of civic and volunteer leaders. I think we ought to start doing that. And if we look at the current leaders, what we will find is that many of them were leaders on the college campuses. And so to me, the first place to start training those future leaders is right here. And let me suggest some things that I think you can do in thinking about a future as leaders. First, I think there are some attitudes of leadership that are helpful. And the first one is an attitude of practice. You see, if you talk about basketball or you talk about other kinds of sports skills, we know you have to practice. The team goes out and it practices. It runs through that. It learns how to do it better. If we talk about drama, we would not just read the script and come in and give a performance. We come and we practice, because that's the way of getting better. If you're talking about taking a math exam, you may skip class, but you are sure going to practice those skills before you go in to take that exam, because you know by spending that kind of time, you're going to be better at it. And so what we know in other parts of our life is that practice is important. It's also important in leadership, because by doing those skills here in club organizations, in campus organizations, I've noticed as I've gone around campus yesterday and today, there are a lot of posters about Visitors Week or New Students Orientation, and lots of things that say we need people to participate in this, because there are lots of ways on campus to participate. And as I look back, that was a lot of what helped me to move ahead in various positions, because I had started practicing leadership. I had discovered some of the skills. I had made some mistakes, but I had learned from them. For example, when I was in the White House, I used to do briefing sessions for 250 people from a state at a time, and they were balanced for business and labor and teachers and men and women and all kinds of different people, but they would come to Washington. They would have the morning being given addresses by various cabinet members. They would have lunch over in the White House, and then the president would come in and speak to them, and I did one day what I always did. I had coffee, tea, served non-dairy creamer, but the people who were there were from Wisconsin, the dairy state. I learned from that experience. I did make some mistakes, but I learned from them. You see, one of the things about leadership is that sometimes when I talk to my own students about doing certain things, they say one of two things. One, they say, but I'm not sure I can do it. Well, that is part of practice, because what I've seen in life is that those people who win generally have lost along the way. We talk about Reagan as the great communicator, but you remember the first time he ran, he lost. It was the second time he won. Or Barbara Jordan, whom I think is a great woman politician from Texas, ran twice and lost. It was the third time she got elected. Or even if you look at Babe Ruth, the same year he had the highest number of home runs batted in, he also had a large number of strikeouts. Because you don't hit the ball unless you swing, and you won't always connect. Or if you look at the Tyson-Spinks fight, do you remember how much money the winner made? $20 million, absolutely. And how much did the loser get? $13.5 million. So in that case, being a loser had a lot of compensation. Or if you think about skiing, do you remember the first time you went skiing? And if you did what I did, I took lessons. And so first you learn to walk like a chicken up the side of a hill. And you kind of plant your feet and move up. And then they teach you what? How to fall down. But I try to be perfect. At least at that point in my life I was. And so I went up and I spent that afternoon trying to come down the baby slope, but I was trying to be perfect. And so I would, you know how you sink, first you're going across and then you shift to one knee and you put that down and you turn your shoulder and you do all that. I spent the whole afternoon doing that, and I was traveling about 0.0001 mile an hour. And I have since learned that you'll have more resistance from the snow than you can ever make progress at that rate. But I was trying to be perfect, and I came down and said to the instructor, I have come the whole way down and I did not fall once. And he said to me, you'll never be a good skier. Because he said, the only people who are ever good are those people who learn to go slightly faster than they are sure of themselves, and who, when they fall down, learn to get up and go again. Part of leadership is practice. The second thing I hear young people say is, but I'm not sure that's something I really want to do. And I would like to encourage them to think about doing something so you learn skills, so that when something else comes along you really want to do, you're prepared. Now, looking back, I'm not sure when people talk to me about running for Secretary of the Student Body that was something I'd always wanted to do. But the skills I learned in running and serving in that office were immensely useful a few years later when someone said, why don't you run for the Texas legislature? Practice. Second, an attitude that I call the use of the critical eye. And by that, what I mean is, I hope as you're in class, as you're in organizations, whether it's church or school, whether it's where you work or the other organizations you're part of, you'll look at what makes a good leader. And what makes you as a person in a group feel real good about being there? What doesn't? Or if you're doing this, watching a speaker, that you'll be looking not only at what are they saying, but what do they do that's effective or not effective. For example, I could be doing this speech from behind the podium. And if I did and simply stood here but tried to use the same style of speech, it would feel a little bit different just because of the separation that a podium does from an audience to a speaker. Or I could be doing what a lot of speakers do, and that is read the speech. And if I did it, it would look like this. Leadership is a very important characteristic. There are, in fact, three attitudes of leadership that I would like to suggest today. The first, do you see what the difference is? Albert Sabin once said that a speech read is like a kiss over the telephone. It may mean the same, but it sure doesn't feel it. And so one of the things in using that critical eye is to see that people who do speeches more in terms of visitation instead of lecturing are generally better speakers. Now, sometimes when we do communication, we get so bogged down in trying to get the words right that it's hard for us to visit instead of trying to do exactly what we have written. One of the things I've learned to do is write out the speech if it's a really important one, but then outline it before I go to give a speech. And now I've gotten good at looking at that outline just before I go on so that I can follow it without having to have it right in front of me. But that was a process of practice for me. I've also learned that sometimes if you're too serious, the speech is not as good. And so I've tried to learn to use some humor in my speeches. In fact, Ann Richards, who some of you saw gave the Democratic keynote, used to work for me. And when she was working for me, she was talking to some members of the press about me, and she said, "Now, it's not that Sarah has no sense of humor. It's just you have to say to her, 'Now, Sarah, this is a joke,' and then she'll laugh." But what I saw was that speakers who could use some humor were better than I was, and so I started trying to look at how do they do that. Part of humor is that all humor has a target, and some targets I will not use whatsoever. But there are other ways of using humor. For example, one of the stories I like is one that illustrates the sort of difficulties of today. I have what I call a reading stack. Some of you may do the same, but it's all that stuff that comes in, you don't have time to read right then, and you put it in a stack. And then when I get ready to go get on an airplane, I take that stack with me. And so on the airplane yesterday, I was reading Time, I was reading Newsweek, I was reading my professional things, and I was reading about AIDS, the number of people with AIDS and the problems that were associated. I was reading about the number of children, young people, who are dropping out of high school and what that means. I was reading about people who'd lost their jobs and are still trying to figure out what to do now. I was reading about people who had personal problems of all kinds. I was thinking about my clients and what I have coming up this week. And I finally was thinking of the words of Bob Hope when he said to a group of graduating seniors, "The world is out there waiting for you. Don't go." Because in one sense, there are a lot of problems left in the world, which essentially will be your inheritance to try to solve. But the use of the critical eye. And the third is confidence, because one of the things we find most difficult about encouraging young women particularly to be in leadership positions is a lack of confidence. Betty Ford was talking about it in terms of the Betty Ford Center, and she was saying that after 28 days of treatment for drug or substance abuse at that center, that generally the men will say, "Our alcohol or our substance abuse was hurting our family, it was hurting our work, we're going to do things differently." But the women tended to say, "I was supposed to be a perfect wife. I was supposed to be a perfect mother. I was supposed to be a perfect person. I'm not. I'm awful." And so that there was a real difference in terms of the kind of confidence that we need to build. And then there are skills of leadership, communication. I won't talk about it more, but I hope all of you here will take a speech class. Perhaps participate in a drama production if you choose. But do those things in class and out of class that help you develop the communication skills. In this presidential election, we have time and time again seen how important those are. Second, human relation skills. Part of being on a campus is trying to learn how to work well with a whole variety of other people. Part of that is learning to appreciate the differences in society. Being able to relate to the motivation other people have. Third is goal setting. Because one of the things that every organization and every individual needs to do is to be able to pick those goals toward which we will work. Now, I believe sometimes we give people bad advice. You know, sometimes people say to me, "What are you going to do now?" And I'm not ever sure I know the answer to that. If anybody had said to me in my senior year, "What are you going to do?" I would have said, "I'm going to teach English and speech in a high school," which I, in fact, have never done, although I'm now teaching at the college level. Or if somebody in the legislature had said to me, "What are you going to do next?" I would have talked about legislation I was going to introduce in Texas instead of going to Washington. What I have learned is that you cannot pick out a title of what you're going to be because the world is changing too fast. In fact, I think about a man who decided some years ago that he wanted to be president of Republic Bank in a little town in Texas. Republic Bank does not exist. Or I talked to a guy in Odessa, Texas, who's been president of a bank for 4 years. He's been physically in the same office the whole time, and he's been president of 3 different banks. Because the world is changing so fast. Or there were lawyers in Texas who said, "We're going to specialize in oil and gas." There is no oil and gas law anymore, and they've had to change. Or I think about a friend of mine who's 58. She is the president of a woman's college. She's raised a major amount of money recently, and she called me the other day to say, "Now I'm trying to decide what I want to do next." What we know is that those of you who are students in this room are likely to have 5 or 6 major parts of your life. Different jobs you'll do at different times. Or for women, perhaps emphasizing career at one time, emphasizing career and family, or family at another time. But instead of saying, "What title do I want?" I believe that what we should be doing is saying, "What can I do today that will give me more options for tomorrow?" And education will give you more options. Knowing people gives you more options. Being known to people, visibility, having participated in activities gives you more options. But to me, the goal setting should be much more in the sense of what can I do today that give me more options, because times are going to change during your lifetime so much. Why should you do leadership? Because there certainly is a cost to it. In fact, sometimes I look at that cost. We all see the visibility of being in the public eye. And other times we see the problems of people who may disagree with you on a certain issue. There are certainly those times when you feel you are the target. Why should you do it? I would suggest to you that the reason is because leadership is the way to make a real contribution and to make a difference. It would be impossible for me, while in college, to have looked ahead and said how I was going to make a difference. Because part of what happens to us is we respond to the parts of our lives. What happens to us often has a real impact on the things we work on and the things we care about. You see, I look back now, and I could never have predicted what would happen. But one of the things that happened to me was my younger sister had breast cancer. And we went through all kinds of things trying to help her. She had a radical mastectomy. We did chemotherapy. We did radiation. We did high-dose LPAM. We got down to what they call the drugstore approach. And in that approach, you just kind of take something off the shelf and give it to them and see if it works. And for her, nothing worked. But while she was in the hospital, we used to have a bulletin board, and we would find things we really liked and put it on the bulletin board. One of the things we found that was on her bulletin board that I still have is a saying that says, "No one on their deathbed ever said, 'I just wish I'd spent more time at work.'" But instead, what people tend to talk about are the things they've done that have made a difference. You see, my father, who is a Methodist preacher, talks about the people he counseled. It wasn't the hours he spent at the church. It was the difference he made in people's lives. Or because of my sister's experience, I have gotten very involved in hospice. Because I look back and I remember a nurse who at one point was seeing people in a hospital in the sterile conditions with nothing they could really do except ease pain. And that nurse said, "Wouldn't it be better If people in this sort of condition could be at home with those they love in their familiar surroundings, and all they need is some help in terms of knowing how to move a patient, how to give shots, how to provide some assistance. And so she started what is called hospice. And I think it is one of the best things anybody's ever done, and I've gotten involved because of my situation. Or I look back at all I've done on women's issues, and I am conscious that much of that came because of things that had happened to me. For example, when I was in high school, I played basketball. I was fairly large, loved playing basketball, but I played half court because at that point it was thought that women couldn't run the full court. And so we would start at one end, we would run to the halfway mark, we would throw the ball to somebody 3 inches away, and they would go the rest of it. We also were limited to 3 dribbles. After 3 dribbles, you had to pass the ball. And I look at that, and now I look at women playing full court, running triathlons and marathons, doing all kinds of things. Or when I went to talk to the dean of my college about going to law school, he said to me, "Well, Sarah, my son's in law school and he's finding it difficult, and no woman from this college has ever done that. I think you ought to decide on something else." Guess what moment I decided to go to law school? But I look back at those limits, and to me, they were not right. You see, I look at graduating from law school, and I went and applied with a big firm. I was the first woman ever to have her way paid from the University of Texas to Dallas to interview with a big firm. But I spent all day with them saying things like, women have to work late. I mean, women have to be home to cook dinner, but lawyers have to work late. How could you possibly do both? Or things like, to really train a young lawyer, we have to be able to cuss him out. We can't cuss you because you're a woman. And they finally offered me the job as a firm librarian, which I turned down. Or if you look at Sandra Day O'Connor, when she and Rehnquist, now Chief Justice, graduated from law school together, he got a great job. They were about equal in their class. She got one job offer from a law firm, and it was as a secretary. And that's why she really understands the old issues of job discrimination. I got involved in women's issues because partially of things that have happened to me and partially a concern for other women. Or look at things like, do you remember when we used to pick up milk cartons and they would have children's faces on them? It was called Child Find. And it started because two people, parents, who had had a son abducted and killed, said there ought to be a better way of trying to locate missing children. And so they started Child Find. Or I was recently in an airport going to catch my plane, and I saw someone coming toward me, and they had a cardboard box. And on the cardboard box it said, "Kidney, rush for transplant." And I was remembering a grandfather whose granddaughter, Ashley Bailey, died. She died because she couldn't get a kidney that she had to have. And so he said, "Isn't there a better way?" And the result today is that there's a computerized hookup for people who have organs to give and those who need them. But it came out of his saying, "Isn't there a better way?" Or there's a little town in Texas where there were a lot of people, older, many women who had lost their husbands, who wanted to stay in their own house and did not want to go to a nursing home. But they couldn't repair things. They couldn't keep them up. And somebody said, "Well, look, there are a lot of men in this town who've retired who are really good at doing that. They need a little extra income. Why don't we set up a system so that people who are senior citizens and need some repairs done can call in and find out other senior citizens who are willing to do those kinds of things for a reasonable price?" And the result is a lot of people have been able to stay in their own home that might not have been able to otherwise. Or if you've ever been to Washington, you may have been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I think it is one of the finest in Washington. Conceived by a man named Jan Scruggs, architect was a young woman, but it is so moving to me. But it was one man's vision that there ought to be a way for us to remember. Or Ronald McDonald Houses. I think they are one of the best corporate charities I've ever seen because they take the money that comes essentially from kids, and they said, "Look, sometimes when children are in the hospital and they're in a hospital in a town where they don't live, where are their parents going to stay? And how can they afford general motel rates? Shouldn't there be a place for the family to stay while kids are getting better?" And they started Ronald McDonald Houses. Or while I've been interested in this whole issue of how you can make a difference for several years now, I noticed USA Today is going to do a survey on neighbors who have made a difference. And so they're asking people to send in the names of people they know. And they started out talking about people in some towns who've helped the homeless, people in other towns who've done housing or who've done foster care for children without families. They've done some other things about people who are doing counseling with those who are coming out of prison and need rehabilitation. They did others on a variety of people. I think they could have done several on teachers, because I look back at the people who taught me, and several of them should have a major credit for things I've been able to do. My speech teacher, for example, used to take credit for anything I'd ever accomplished. And maybe she's entitled to that, because she taught me a lot. You see, I look back, and I have had such fun working in the White House, arguing before the Supreme Court, being in the Texas legislature. In college, I never thought about those things as options, but they are doors that have opened through the years. Opened because I practiced leadership, because I had tried to learn the skills of leadership, and because I cared. Some people have said to me, "How did you, as such a young woman, do the Roe versus Wade case?" You know, and in some ways, I think younger people are better able to do it than older people. Because when you first come out of law school, you're used to living on nothing. The longer you're out of school, the more you're used to having a mortgage and a car payment and credit cards you have to pay on. I said, sometimes I think it's because in law school, what you learn is the theory of law. The longer you're out, the more you just want to know how to do a traffic ticket, how to write a will. And the third is because when you're younger, you still are in that part of life when you ask the questions about how should it be, it should not be this way, isn't there a better way? And the older we get, the more we're inclined to say, that's just the way it is. What can you do? I would hope as you leave here that you would constantly ask those questions about those things which are not what they should be, and how you can make them better. One person can make a difference in small ways and in large ways, in the family, in the church, in school, in communities, in a nation. The key to it is to try. As you leave here, I hope you will ask the question, is this what it should be? And if it's not, I hope you will use the skills you've learned here to try to make a difference. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Sarah Weddington. She addressed the topic, You Can Make a Difference. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.